It's June 15th, 2012. This is the Hell Yeah Show. Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Emery.
And we are bringing you best practices for fine living, advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. Emery.
Humanity's desperate cry.
That's right. You'll learn later in the show what humanity's desperate cry is. But it has to do with LinkedIn, so
yeah,
there's some a teaser for you. We've got lots of stuff to talk about today. We've been gone a few weeks due to some crazy schedules all around, but yeah. Hopefully we're back on track.
You're officially done with diorama season?
Diorama season has officially ended yesterday. Now we're in...
We got a slow clap for Alan.
Yeah.
That's great.
Anyway, we're in the post-diorama era now, so
PD, if you will.
Anyway, so in these, we got a lot of stuff to go back through because a couple weeks of news and a couple weeks of us doing things, and yeah. I guess we probably wanted to start with Aperture, right?
Yeah, you actually okay? So when I was talking about getting a new camera again, you mentioned that. You had bought the latest version of Aperture and that you were really liking it. And I was like, well, man, I kind of like, you know, I like the idea of it. Maybe I should check it out again. And you were like, just, you know, stop thinking about it. Just buy it.
Yeah. I mean, it is, I think, $80 on the App Store. It's a, you know, you download it instantly. It's, you know, it's easy.
It got so much better yesterday.
Oh yeah, totally.
Like I was having like not buyer's remorse, but I was kind of like, you know, it's kind of this pain because I was like constantly flipping back and forth because I've got multiple iPhoto libraries, right? Yeah, like I've got an iPhoto library that lives on the NAS, and that's where like, you know, the family photos go. And then I have my like my personal iPhoto library on my workstation that's basically like, you know, my photo stream stuff and like, you know, odds and ends. And just like when I take snapshots with my camera or my iPhone, things like that. And then I also was like just starting to like build a project library in Aperture, which is like and I guess the main competitor to this would be like Adobe Lightroom, right?
Yeah, Adobe Lightroom plus Photoshop. Aperture's got some features that kind of border on Photoshop stuff, but it's nowhere near the level of tweaking you can do in there.
No, and since, I mean, given first of all my skill set and secondly my means and then thirdly what I'm actually looking to do, Aperture looked like the best bet. I certainly wasn't going to buy Photoshop. That's kind of a non-starter.
Yeah.
I think the last time I actually like owned a copy of Photoshop, it was Photoshop 4.
Yeah.
Whenever they introduced layers. Was that 4?
Okay.
Was 4.
Yeah. That's yeah. That's a big step. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, I had a Quadra 630. So what do you want?
Excellent.
But, I really like Aperture a lot. And then, after WWDC, which is a big deal for OS X and, iOS developers, it's like, you know, Apple's big thing. They released a lot of really cool stuff that we'll talk about later, but some software updates came out that let you use the same library format for Aperture and iPhoto, which
right.
is excellent. That, you know, my troubles are over, dude.
Yeah, so, and I've
fixes
actually,
everything.
I've bounced back between Aperture and iPhoto at various points, so it's actually kind of cool. Although I have everything in Aperture now, including my iPhone photo stream stuff. That stuff goes into Aperture as well.
I don't know if I don't know that I'll do that, except that now it's not quite a hard decision. I mean, I probably will now.
Yeah.
But
I'm
loving it. I think it's great. My only complaint is that, my new camera, the Fuji X10, which is doing fantastic. I took some really good photos this week with that, especially because, you know, I've got someone really photogenic around.
Yeah, totally.
So I'm pretty much like
there's like
a camera.
There the saying goes, like, every new dad, you know, should have a digital, you know, like an SLR or a nice point and shoot digital camera, because it's just like, yeah, tons of great photo opportunities.
Yeah, I have some real doozies, though. They're just adorable. But anyways, the
I've
raw
seen your
photos.
Google Plus stream, which...
I'm trying it out.
Yeah.
And we also set up a Hell Yeah Show Google Plus page.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, you can now find Hell Yeah Show on the Google Plus. I don't. We probably won't talk about this show, but at some point in the future, we'll do some sort of a Google Plus rundown.
Yeah, sure. But apparently, the Fuji X10 stuff, when it shoots a raw image, which I don't do a lot, but sometimes I do, especially if it's like kind of sketchy. Mm-hmm. If I'm really not sure if I've got either the exposure and metering correct or things like that, then I'm more likely to want to shoot raw just so I can change it after the fact.
Right. Yeah.
But it doesn't support the raw format.
Oh, really? X10.
Yeah. So I have to use like this. I don't know. I guess I could call it like almost like a darkroom step where I take the raw images and then I run them through the Fuji software, which is horrible.
Yeah,
or
sure.
Here's the other cool thing though, is that Adobe, who I ordinarily hate with the passion of a thousand suns, they have this free open raw converter, so you can like open raw files and then save them into like whatever the open raw format.
Nice. It's a different raw format. It's not like you're converting to JPEGs. Yeah.
No. Yeah, it's converting from the proprietary Fuji raw into, I don't know if it's Adobe sponsored, and I haven't actually
camera raw.
Yeah, there is some like open raw specification that Aperture and everything else can understand in Photoshop too.
Yeah.
So I've done both where I've looked at it. I like the Adobe thing because then I can just bulk convert into this open raw format and then import them into my library and do my edits in Aperture,
cool. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. That works.
I like that a lot.
So have you, I've seen a few photos on your Google Plus stream, but is there somewhere where you're posting this stuff publicly? Like the, you know,
well,
sort of,
not
do you,
really
do you have like an artsy photo page somewhere that people can check out?
Yeah. Yeah. It's hellyeahshownudes.com. No, there's, I have that, that Facebook group for like my family. That's where most of my photos are going right now.
Okay. Okay.
Of the Prue Bear.
But are you going out and taking like nature photos yet, or you know, is it mostly friends and family photos?
Yeah, it's mainly kiddo and just like stuff around, walking around.
All right.
I don't know.
That's cool.
I haven't done any. I don't know. I do like really enjoy the candid street stuff, but haven't had a lot of time.
Right. Yeah. Cool.
But
right.
That's been working out really well though. I really like Aperture a lot, and I'm glad you mentioned it to me. And I was seriously just elated yesterday, which is not really an exaggeration, because I was like, oh, this is awesome when I could finally like just use the single library.
Right. Right.
Or, you know, at least interchange them. That was really great.
Cool. And then also you've been checking out Google Drive, I'm told.
Yeah, so you know, I know you use Dropbox, and
I do.
And I use it too. I mean, I don't put anything like confidential or even sensitive on Dropbox, but I do use it for things like wallpapers, and like just little odds and ends, and like shell scripts, and there's like text expander macros for
there's a really cool ecosystem of apps that, and we've talked a little bit about this, but that use Dropbox as their, you know, storage medium.
Yeah, and some of that's like, I mean, there are some people that are doing that and iCloud or one or the other. And to be completely honest, like I kind of like the way that the iCloud stuff works. Like when I'm using Writer, I love the iCloud open save dialogues, and I really like how that works. And I kind of prefer it, but at the same time, I can also see why a lot of people prefer Dropbox. Mainly because it's, you know, they already understand like a hierarchical file system, and they know like this is a folder that's being synchronized. Like they get that. Whereas iCloud is still kind of this, I don't know, it's voodoo, you know, like you don't really, I mean, you can't like handle it in the same way.
Yeah.
So there is a difference, but, the Google Drive thing is pretty cool. I've been using it, one neat thing I like about it is that, like when we do our show notes on Google Docs, like those show up on my computer.
Yep. And actually what was really great is it gave me the chance to bulk rename all of our show notes.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can rename the local copy, and then that actually translates into the Google Docs copy.
That's a good point.
So I went through and I renamed all of our show notes such that you can alphabetize them now and they'll go in order.
That's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really sweet.
Yeah, it was great. So, if nothing else, I appreciated the ability to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just, it seems like, I don't know. I mean, for the cost, if you're on a free Dropbox account, then you have more storage with the Google Drive. And I think the software for Google Drive is a little hokey, and I haven't really stressed its synchronization engine. Like on the Dropbox side, their engine that determines like what's changed in a file is amazing.
Oh, it's great. And it's surprisingly CPU efficient as well.
Well, yes. And because of that, it's even more like network efficient, you know,
right?
Like, and the Dropbox stuff for like peering with your local network. So, like, if I am working on my laptop and I change a file, it's not. I mean, it will send that file to Dropbox, but it will also send it to the other machines on my network that are using Dropbox instead of having to have them go out to Dropbox and download it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you didn't
I
know about
no
that?
Idea it did that. Wow.
Yeah, that's
you can, super you can clever. Disable
it. There's a what do they call it? Land sync. Huh. It's under your general options in Dropbox.
That's great.
And that's what that does. It's pretty cool because then you don't have to. I mean, you will be uploading stuff to Dropbox, obviously, but it gives you very quick sync on your local network, which is pretty fantastic.
Yeah. Well, so there was a point where, let me just say this, Google Drive is not currently running on my computer.
Okay.
There was a point where I saw it consistently using about 2% of the CPU and for an extended period of time, and after that I ceased to trust it to run constantly. I don't know if that's just my experience. I don't know if that, you know, that's because of the way it's architected, but
I have no idea. Like, I actually haven't like delved into it and tested it the same way that I did with Dropbox. So I don't know, like some of the problems that, you will commonly have with, and I also have no idea if Google Drive respects like metadata on files. I kind of doubt it. I know Dropbox does. But I'm not especially optimistic. But like I said, for things that I keep in Google Docs, having a way to like manipulate them, at least you know visually on the local file system, I think is helpful.
Yeah.
So even if I never use it as like a repository for stuff, the stuff that I keep in Google Docs is it's good to have access to it like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
And
I think
it's also offline. Like you know, it's like an automatic backup of the stuff that you have in Google Docs.
Yep.
If nothing else.
Yeah. No. I think like initially I was a bit skeptical because it seems like there could be room for a lot of confusion about what is Docs and what is Drive. But I think combining the two actually does make sense for the reasons that you know you've just put out there. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes for them. I mean, there's a lot of things they're kind of trying out and. It's interesting to see Google kind of start to struggle a little bit.
Look back at Wave or Buzz or you know, I mean they've
okay. First of all, I'm still bitter about the Wave thing.
Yeah, and I'm aware.
Did you talk about? I've had some time to watch TV and catch up on some shows that I wanted to watch lately. Did you tell me about Game of Thrones?
There was a show where I mentioned that I was reading the books and and I think at that point I'd ordered the TV series on Blu-ray.
So I haven't read the books and I don't think I ever will, but I've been watching the show and I'm almost done with season one right now and I love it.
It's amazing.
It is really difficult to follow though. I had to find there's an infographic out there that's like the Game of Thrones families.
This is where reading the books does like is pretty pretty helpful, right? Like,
yeah, but I've been burned on books before. I hate to.
Yeah, they're good. They're really good.
I have nothing against books in general, but the last time that I got really invested in like a series of like fantasy novels, like a serial, was Robert Jordan's The Wheel of Time series.
Yeah,
and right around book 7 is where, like, maybe it's even earlier. I don't even know how many they made, and I don't remember how many I read. But I read a lot of them, and they were huge books. And when I started losing interest, it was because it was taking several pages to like describe like the most like mundane, stupid. It became tedious to read.
Yeah,
and it stopped being entertaining or fun for me. So I'm really just kind of like do I really want to start up another? Because I was seriously,
it will
like,
be
I still haven't
a significant.
I've been complaining about Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, for years, and you know he died like a few years ago. He never finished it. Like it's just,
It's a significant investment to commit to reading through the Game of Thrones books, because yeah, they're already very long. There are already several of them, and there will be several more. So
yeah. So yeah. I'm afraid, you know, like it's like if you've had a really bad breakup and then it takes you a while to like want a date because you know what,
you're on the fantasy novel.
What if you start having feelings for them and then they turn around and they do something horrible to you like Robert Jordan did to me.
I don't know. George R. R. Martin, he seems like a, you know, he's a guy you can depend upon.
All right. Well, I'll think about it.
Anyway, the TV show. So I have to ask this. Who is your favorite character?
Arya.
Oh, okay. That's a solid choice.
Yeah, she's awesome.
And I mean, and how much do you know about the trajectory of this series?
Okay. So first of all, we're not going to ruin anything.
We're not going to no spoilers on this show.
I haven't seen episode 10, but I'm aware of what has happened because I just finished episode 9 tonight, and I also know the controversy about the George W. Bush head.
Okay. So you're an informed.
Well, sadly, because I'd heard this wild tale about the head on the pike at the keep or whatever, and I was trying and I wanted to read an article and Liz was like, I found this article and it ruined, like, I know something I don't want to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, that's so rough. And so you guys watching it? Now I wanted to know.
Are you guys on the same episode together?
Yes.
Okay.
But
awesome.
She was the one that read like a spoiler first.
Yeah.
Inadvertently. And then I did just, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's plenty of other shocking moments that,
I'm sure
that are in store for you. So,
that's good. Have you finished watching season one?
Yeah. So I've finished watching season one. I've finished the first about book and a half. And I've finished watching season two.
It's a very confusing, like, seriously, I don't even know that reading the books would help me.
No, it helps. I mean, like, I watched season one through with a couple friends and we were pausing like every 5 minutes so that I could explain things to them.
Like, well, I mean, no offense, but your friends are calling it.
Okay, fine.
But wait, are these like Stanford friends or like,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, a couple of Stanford friends.
Oh, okay, well then.
Yeah, well, yeah, they should be able to follow along. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, it's, you know, the families, as you were saying, the locations, that there's so much stuff going on that it is super hard to follow. And I rewatched the first season with commentary, and it's amazing how much you pick up that even reading the books, watching the series for the first time, there's still stuff that watching through it the second time, I'm like, oh, that's what they meant there. Or, you know, that, oh, that's,
oh, really?
You know, that's what this scene was supposed to be. Yeah. So, it is surprisingly unapproachable for such a popular show.
Yeah, I think I actually tried watching like episode one once and I got like halfway. I mean, maybe because I was doing something else at the time too, but I was just basically like, you know, what is this?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what am I doing? And then I kind of gave up. And then we decided to sit down and give it a try. And I'm loving it.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think fantastic. Arya's my favorite character so far. And there is a certain blonde lad that I would just love to see get like trampled by a horse.
the prince. Yeah.
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 You know, there's, I mean, people said that, oh, it's really violent and there's lots of gratuitous nudity. And first of all, I have not found the nudity to be at all gratuitous. But secondly,
that's generally opinion among the male viewers. I think that,
well, I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm like, well, you know, this is clearly a cultural thing. You know, this is like, you know, National Geographic, the topless women.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Yeah, these are insights into the culture of Westeros.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
All right. That's fair.
I'm glad you see it my way.
Yeah,
so
sure.
However, I will agree, it is exceptionally violent. Like, we're talking Mortal Kombat fatality violent.
Oh, I know. The like
geysers of blood.
Well, what's interesting to see is like there are violent moments that they will cut away from or that they'll like not show. And what's weird is like often those moments are not as bad as the moments that they actually show.
Yeah.
It's,
well,
it's,
then again, maybe the reason that the ones that they show are so bad is because they show them, you know. Like,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a certain element of that, I'm sure. But yeah. there's been some stuff on that show that is kind of blowing my mind.
Yeah, it's only on HBO, I guess. It's yeah.
Apparently, Television Without Pity, which is one of Liz's favorite websites, has really good reviews of television shows, and some of their writers are better than others. But I guess the person that does a lot of the recaps for Game of Thrones is like, and in case you forgot, this is on HBO, so you see blah. You know, like there's a lot of like sideline ribbing there about the somewhat mature content of the program.
Right. Right. But it's in general, I'm a big fan of the you know, the books are really well written and really engaging, and the series is just they could not have executed any better on the you know, good qualities of the books. I mean, they shine through in the series really well.
It seems really well cast.
Yeah, oh man, the casting is incredible.
I always like good casting, and this show definitely nails it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the this comes up in the commentary, but like the fact that they're able to find like really competent child actors is surprising and unusual, you know, in a television show.
Yes and no. So what happens a lot of times is that they'll have like a really good child actor who becomes a really horribly awkward pubescent actor.
Right, right.
Like on the show Roseanne, the actor that plays DJ was actually a really good actor in the beginning, but towards the end of the show, he was pretty bad.
Yeah, but, yeah,
yeah. It's just there's stuff like that happens on shows with actors all the time.
Yeah, yeah. But then you know the whole cast, the you know Peter Dinklage and
he's amazing.
He's fantastic.
He was great on Seinfeld too.
And then what's his name? The guy who plays Ned, Sean Bean.
I don't know his name.
Sean Bean. Yeah, he's he played Boromir.
Okay.
Yeah. He's a fantasy classic.
You know what is hilarious though is that the guy that plays Jaime Lannister, I think, looks a lot like Dennis Leary. So like the first time he came on camera, I was like, oh, it's Dennis Leary.
Yeah.
Then I was like, well, wait, that can't be. why would he be doing this show?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Anyway, but yeah, it's if you've not seen it yet, the first season is out there on DVD and Blu-ray and a bunch of, you know, online download services, both legal and non-legal.
Well, and HBO, the iTunes.
Yeah, iTunes has the entire first season, so definitely worth checking out.
I don't know if I've told you about this, but I still have never seen you online in Diablo 3.
Okay, yeah, so this... Yeah, Diablo 3 is like this... It's kind of embarrassing because it's like this game that I really should be playing because everyone else is playing it and everyone says it's awesome and it's, you know, obviously it is awesome. It got incredible reviews. I don't know. I've been playing Terra and Demon's Souls, and I checked out a little bit of Uncharted 1 the other day.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's
really it's fantastic. Good. But I mean, yeah, it's just weird that I just don't feel the same. I don't feel the same draw to Diablo 3 as it seems like everyone around me is feeling.
Well, to be fair, you haven't played it.
However, I've played a few hours. However, I read a post the other day by someone who said that they made $250 on the Real Money auction house, and that made me really want to play Diablo 3.
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah.
So, what's kind of amazing about the Real Money auction house. So Diablo 3, if you play, there's an auction house, and then there's like the normal mode, and then there's hardcore mode. So if you play on the normal mode side, which a lot of people do, I think probably most, they have just introduced this week something called the Real Money auction house, where you can deposit money into your account with Blizzard, and then you can use that money on the auction house. So you can use gold to buy stuff, and then there's another auction house that you can use that uses money. And like the maximum amount you can sell something for on there is $250. So as you may imagine, there are a ton of things up on the auction house for $250. And I don't know that any of them are selling, but apparently they are. But there are people enraged in game about this auction house. Like they are seriously like losing their minds.
This
and I'm
is
like
great.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. It's hilarious because they knew that it was coming from the word go. Like this is not a big surprise. And if you don't want there to be a Real Money auction house, then you play on hardcore.
Right.
Because then you don't have to worry about it. So really, you know, there's like this, and it's always like, I'm a veteran gamer, and this is like destroying the purity of my gaming environment. I cannot believe that people will allow money to taint this game. And I'm like, you know, and it was already happening. Like,
well, if it didn't happen through legitimate means, it would have happened through illegitimate means, right?
And because it was, and it is, and it still will.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. What's nice about this, though, is that it, I think it can do a lot to lower the value of people's game accounts. Because what's been happening is gaming accounts for World of Warcraft and for Diablo 3, apparently, have been targeted really heavily by people who run like these botnets and harvest account credentials and then log into your account and like take all your stuff and sell everything and then transfer the virtual currency from A to B and et cetera, et cetera. So I think having like a legitimate path and it's all to kind of like fuel this black market of in-game currency is
right.
really what it comes down to. And I think by them starting to try to find a way to somewhat legitimize that and make it part of the game, I think that the hope is, and what I think is actually going to happen, maybe not to the extent that it, you know, that we would like things to, but I think that it might end up having a side effect of lowering the value of these stolen accounts, which would be good for everybody. Now, the other part of this is that now they're using real currency in some cases. Now, when people's accounts get compromised, now it's something that law enforcement will start to give a rip about.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't even thought about that.
Huh. See, here's and this might just be like my conspiracy theory brain working overtime here, but my thinking is that, you know, you call the FBI and you're like,
yeah, we've got like 15,000 compromised accounts for people that are trading gold. And like, oh, really, gold? And they're like, well, it's gold for a video game. You know, and yeah. the FBI's like, you know, sorry, I'm going into tunnel. I'm going to drop this call, you know, because they don't care.
Yeah.
But if there's real money involved, then now all of a sudden, now people start to give a crap.
Right.
So I think now, to be fair, they've done some additional precautions on the real money auction house. So you have to have an authenticator. So you have to have two-factor authentication.
Oh, that's smart. Okay. Cool.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's good. And
yeah.
I think everyone should have that anyways. But there are, for some stupid reason, like, I don't even know these people that are posting threads like on their support site, like, my account's been hacked and I lost all my gold. You guys suck.
And I'm like, you're the idiot that like is running malware on your computer. Like, it's not Blizzard's fault.
Right.
And there's all sorts of like conspiracy theories about this. Like, I was in a public game and there was this guy with a Chinese name and I think he did it. Like, he's hacked the Blizzard servers.
Yeah, clearly.
You know, there's all these like really far-fetched like tales. And obviously the most logical explanation for all of this is that, you know, they've got a copy of Adobe Flash that they installed 3 years ago and their web browser has been like dutifully sending back passwords left and right. And the thing is that these game accounts, because no one cares about them, that's a way people are making money on these account credentials that they're taking, because they don't want to necessarily log into like your bank account unless they're good to go. Like,
no, but yeah, a large number of low value accounts that are not that are not seen as that important of a commodity.
Just want to stay off the radar. Because
right.
like these people that set up like these big like ad network botnets and things like that, like they eventually get taken down. Like there's there was one just not too long ago where they still have like three people missing, but they did like an overnight raid and got like three people in Estonia and like one in Romania.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, like they take this kind of thing very seriously when you start talking about like cash.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. That'll be cool to watch. Oh. I had not even considered that. So that's a really cool thought about the maybe possible motivations behind this. I don't know if that was actually going through Blizzard's mind, but I think that's certainly...
I don't see how they couldn't be. I mean, they have to have a better deterrent, because this is probably the single largest cost center for their customer support line.
Yeah.
I'm willing to bet that they are dealing with more phone calls and more trouble tickets from people who have had their accounts compromised than any other issue. Because what else would people be complaining about?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, complaining enough to pick up the phone and call. Like billing stuff, which is like, or trying to cancel the account or getting it reactivated or changing an address, like that's one thing. And you're never going to get rid of that. But this type of thing, I would suspect, is costing Activision Blizzard a lot of money.
So there has to be a good reason that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So, all right, well, I mean, yeah, and having said that, I have sold something on the Real Money Auction House.
Oh, I want to hear about this. Okay.
It was, you know, I'm not quitting my job as a professional podcaster.
Uh-huh. No. Yeah, right.
I sold something. I don't even remember what it was. I think it was a weapon. There's so many people selling stuff or trying to sell stuff for these absurd prices. I just put up a bunch of stuff for like $2 and $3.
Okay.
And that's, I mean, I put up like, you know, half a dozen things and I sold one for $3.
Wow.
Now,
all right.
I have spent about $20 on Real Money.
Oh, dear. Okay. We're going to need to have a chat about this.
We might. However, I don't know. It's the first time I did something, I was like, oh, well, you know, because I can, because it's there.
Uh-huh.
And then I was like, oh, okay, well, this is kind of cool. And I'm looking for a deal. And then I, of course, realized that what I'm doing is completely asinine. But, you know, on the other hand, like, if it's something that, see, this is a game that, the way these games work, I mean, it's what am I going to do? I'm not going to invest the time to farm this stuff. So if I can pay $5,
yeah, okay,
to save myself, you know, several hours of disappointment, then I'll probably do it.
Okay, I guess that,
just to be more efficient.
Yeah, that's reasonable. I don't see myself jumping into that side of the Real Money Auction House, but.
Now, if I start asking you to, like, you know, log into my PayPal account and freeze me out. Then we can have a talk.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so you and everyone else has been playing Diablo 3. Do you want to hear about what I've been playing instead?
Yeah, your stupid hamster game.
Yeah, the stupid
hamster game.
You're playing
hamster dance?
I'm playing Hamster Dance Online.
You sent me this picture of like a sorceress hamster.
And sorcerer. I believe he is male, but I'm not actually sure about that. They don't let you choose a race, or they don't let you choose a gender with the hamster race.
Of course not.
They're ambiguously gendered hamsters. There's
I've never seen any other kind.
Yeah,
actually, that's not true. You know, like those Chinese hamsters that have really large genitals. Have you seen those?
No.
I knew someone that had like a pet, and when I was younger, and I'll send you a picture.
Okay,
you would not believe. There's people, you know, steering their cars off cliffs right now. We'll talk another time about that.
All right. Anyway,
tell me of your hand.
So there's this MMO called Terra, T-E-R-A, that was originally a Korean MMO, and about a month and a half ago they released a U.S. version of it. And it's, you know, in a lot of ways it's your typical MMO, you know, typical quest structure, typical leveling structure, and all that. But the combat model is actually really great. It's you know, instead of press button to do some skill that takes the next 1 second or, you know, 3 seconds to cast, it feels very instantaneous. And it actually, I mean, it's very action-y. Feels kind of Diablo-y, actually. Like it's a lot more in that direction than your typical MMO.
So at what point in the game do you get like the water bottle with a little ball bearing in it to like suck on? Or the cedar chips that you sleep on. Where are those?
It's so there are other races besides the hamsters.
Are there grasshoppers?
But yeah,
I'd love to play
grasshoppers. It was too hilarious an opportunity to pass up. But it's, you know, it's not. I'm probably not going to stick with it. I've put a few hours into it, and it's been interesting. I think I'm level 22, something like that. But the end game stuff is all five man. It's all, you know, all five person group stuff. Oh. There's no big raids or anything. You know, so the main draw is the combat, which is actually pretty engaging and is really, you know, when you're in groups taking on some massive enemy, and you've got this really instantaneous combat where you're ducking and rolling and dodging and, you know, firing off, skills in between all that, and you're all in a group setting. It's actually it feels a lot more dynamic. It's a lot less of standing in one spot and pressing three buttons in order.
Huh. I think last time we talked, I was playing through hell on Diablo 3, and I have since with my witch doctor, I'm level cap now, and I'm playing through Inferno. But I am just getting my rear handed to me in Act 2.
Oh really?
Oh yeah. There's like a, I don't
and
know.
And this
if it's
is
a,
not. There's a level above hell, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm on Inferno.
Oh, you're.
I'm on
oh,
the,
this
I'm
is
on the last.
Oh, okay. Yeah, got it. Okay.
And it is brutal. And I don't know if this is like just because I'm terrible or because it's a massive gear check or I just lack the skill. But I mean, like, have you found this Terra game? Does it like seem to have a pretty smooth progression in terms of difficulty? Or
so certainly, like, I mean, you're the fact that your ability set expands dramatically. You know, between it, you know, almost like, I mean, it's not so much like, you know, you get a couple new abilities every few levels, but the combinations of those abilities expand exponentially, and you end up taking on significantly larger and more dynamic enemies, to the point where, like, the first big enemies you take on basically stand in one place and you hop around them and, you know, avoid them reaching out for you.
Sure.
But the you know, as you get higher up, like, the enemies actually they'll teleport around and they'll, you know, duck and roll and dodge your attacks. And you know, it actually, that probably is where the difficulty ramps up the most. But it is still perfectly possible to just grind your way through it.
Is like one of the bosses, like a girl in kindergarten who has to take you home for the weekend to keep you alive.
You know, now I'm thinking, like, maybe they should have just gone whole hog on the hamster premise. Just
I think they should. That would be, you got to commit to it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Anyway, but yeah, so that's that is the less exciting half of my news, my stuff for the past few weeks. The more exciting half is,
oh, no.
Is definitely the fact that I bought a MacBook Air. Yeah.
Good for you. I love mine. Like, it's seriously, I can't say enough nice things about them.
So I got the, you know, because they just revised, we'll talk about later in the show, they just, you know, refreshed their laptop line. And new MacBook Airs, now with the option for an i7 processor in it, which I thought was pretty sweet. Some expanded, or some higher end graphics and cheaper flash storage and whatnot. So went ahead and went for it, because I'm tired of carrying this 15-inch laptop around with me. It's too heavy and too big. So
it's weird too, because, like, you don't want to say it's too heavy.
Yeah, I mean, like, I mean, 4 years ago, I thought this 15-inch laptop was a revelation. Like,
they are svelte.
Yeah. I mean, my previous one was a 17-inch, you know, older MacBook Pro.
Oh, yeah.
And that thing was
my BFF has owned, like, every model of the 17-inch since they've been released. And, like, it was such a difference. Like, I think the last time I saw him, I want to say I had, like, my 11-inch Air at the time. And, like, when I picked up his, like, seriously, I was just like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, they're amazing.
But it's amazing how standards have changed in, you know, and, like, yeah, I am done carrying a 15-inch laptop around.
I was surprised that they had the i7. I mean, when you said that you got an i7 version of the Air, I didn't even know that they were offering one now.
Yeah, it's so the standard is, so the, of the 13 inches, the standard is i5. But you can do a you know, custom upgrade to a
pretty
nice i7.
And the i5s that they use, the i5s that they ship, like the one that I have and on my 13-inch is a, I mean, they're a dual core with the hyper-threading, so you have four logical processors that show up. So it is, I mean, they're definitely not a slouch.
No, I'm going to sort of, because I've still got a fairly recent MacBook Pro from about 2 years ago that works quite well and, you know, runs Aperture really smoothly and, you know, stores all my iTunes library and all that stuff. So I'm not entirely sure that I want to just dump this machine and go entirely to the MacBook Air. But I'm going to sort of try it out and see if maybe that's a possibility. You know, once I figure out, like, how to put my music somewhere online, rather than storing it locally and that sort of stuff.
Have you ever tried iTunes Match?
Have not. No, I mean, I'm a Spotify subscriber, so that's my main solution, but that doesn't, you know, they will not store all your music for you. I don't know if iTunes Match does that or not.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, well, that might be an option.
And it's cheap. It's like $20 a year.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
And then also, which was announced at WWDC, iOS 6 will let you stream directly from iTunes Match without having to download.
Nice. Yeah.
So you could pretty much have like your entire iTunes library on your iPhone without having to actually have it on there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But I think, I mean, as much as I love the Air, I probably would not make it my primary. I mean, for all intents and purposes, a lot of the time it is my primary machine because it's what I'm carrying around most of the time.
Yeah.
But the fact that it relies on the integrated video kind of precludes me from wanting it for everything.
Yeah.
And I don't know that. Maybe it's just because I occasionally play a game and I want it to not suck.
So the new integrated,
I think that's really what it is.
The new integrated video card on these new models is apparently better. It supports DirectX 11, which is impressive.
Really. I mean, the DirectX 11 has been supported since like the 5000 series ATI cards. Like,
it's impressive for an integrated graphics chip. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it's, I mean, just because it supports DirectX 11
doesn't mean it's going to perform well.
Fast.
Yeah. No, and then what I was going to say is, but it's still an integrated graphics chip, so it's probably going to perform terribly.
Well, and that's just it. Like, it's actually, the integrated Intel stuff is phenomenal at encoding video.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So the generation before, so like the, I guess the second generation Air, which is what I had in the 11 inch, that guy had a discrete GPU.
Right.
But it was a Core 2 Duo though. And so I wasn't liking that. But the subsequent ones have all been integrated video all the time. And I was kind of disappointed because I was hoping that this bump this time around would bring us something else. But I also know that most people that buy an Air don't give a rip if it has a GPU or not.
Yeah. I don't fault
them for not including it. Yeah. I mean, it's like, yeah. So,
and the other thing I'm going to be testing, I, you know, really historically have not liked the glossy screens. So, you know, if like, I'm going to have to convince myself that I could move to a permanent laptop with a glossy screen. You know, so I don't know if that's.
Well, you know, did you, I mean, like the MacBook Pro with Retina, that guy supposedly cuts down on glare quite a bit.
Yeah, because it's got the more unified body to screen enclosure that should help that. But it, of course, the MacBook Air does not have that, so it's still going to be traditional glossy. And I've heard it's tolerable, but
are delightful machines. I hope you can look past it.
Yeah. And one other thing, I went for the 8 gigabytes of RAM because it is not user upgradable. So,
and it's also only $100.
And it's $100, which is historically like Apple used to sell RAM for way above market price. And $100 for 4 gigabytes is still a bit pricey. But the fact that it's this soldered on RAM, like I'm willing to forgive a bit of a premium.
Oh yeah,
so.
Please.
It's fine.
Hey, you know, like this is like the people on Macintosh that are like raging and screaming because the MacBook Retina is like, oh, it's got like a proprietary SSD and the RAM is soldered to it. This sucks. And I'm like, first of all, like when in the history of Apple ever have they sold a machine? I mean, I guess
the Mac
like
Pro.
Sort of.
No.
I mean, okay. That one is built for that. But every other machine has always. If there is a decision to be made between aesthetics and design versus accessibility, they will always choose aesthetics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Period. Like they have never not done that. And these unibody machines, they're so thin, they can't risk flex. So of course they're going to solder and weld everything that they can and make it as solid. Like, the whole point is that they have to find ways to reinforce it if they're going to have something be that slender and that light and that beautiful. I mean, to be frank, like if you want something that's user serviceable, you are never going to buy an Apple product anyways.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
For the love of God, like, have you ever seen what happens when you try to install memory in an old Power Mac 9500? Like, I am pretty sure that I still have scars on my hands from that because you had to remove the CPU daughter cards, all expansion cards that you had plugged in, the power supply had to come out, and you had to remove part of the motherboard in order to get to the part past the heatsink where all the DIMMs were.
Wow.
And there were like 16 memory slots.
Yeah, I mean, recent MacBook Pros have been actually surprisingly good about, you know, it's typically pretty easy to access the RAM. But certainly,
that's it.
It's no longer a removable battery. It hasn't been for years.
Yep.
There are people like screaming about the Kensington cable lock thing, which I could not care less about. I don't know. It's I think they're all beautiful and fantastic machines, and I think that the Retina display is a really good move. I think that and you know that it's not like they've completely committed to it either. They're still shipping a bumped revised version of a non-Retina version of the MacBook Pro as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's less that it's not so much that they are not fully committed to it. It's more just that they cannot get the price point in line with where they'd like to, you know, like they can't roll this across all of their MacBook Pros and have the price points be at the price point they like to have their MacBook Pro line at.
Oh, and my favorite one was like this guy that's like complaining about, you know, I don't even want a lighter of laptop because my laptop sits on my desk 95% of the time anyways. You know what I really want is another hard drive. And I'm like, then get an external hard drive because your computer's on your desk 95% of the time anyways. Like,
or get a desktop.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other, and he's like, and now I got to carry around a dongle for Ethernet. And I'm like, yes, the 5% of the time that you move your laptop from your desk, you will have to strap that dongle to your back and walk it to your next meeting. Like, are you kidding me with this? Climb down off your cross.
Yep. Yep. So I figure we're already talking about it. So, you know, the MacBook Pro, the new Retina display, MacBook Pro released at or announced at WWDC and available now, right?
Yes.
As far as I know.
People are actually getting them right now. So for people that don't know what the Retina display is, it's basically a high DPI. What is it? 200 DPI? Most displays are like,
240?
You know, 72.
It's over 200.
So you're jumping from like, you know, 70, 80 dots per inch to a very high pixel density. So you essentially, on this 15-inch laptop display, its native resolution is, what is it, 2880 by...
More than 1080p by a long shot.
Yeah, it's almost twice the resolution visible of a high-definition 1080p TV. So, but you can also run it in like this, and people are always like, well, then how are you going to see anything if everything's so small? And the solution to that is the high DPI graphics modes. So you can actually, there's some flexibility in how things look on that display, but you don't see the pixels, you know,
right.
Like it is that clear. And if you've seen like the display on the iPad 3 or the new iPhone, it's a very similar look. By all accounts, just beautiful.
So 2880 by 1800 at 220 pixels per inch.
I'm just amazing.
It's
yeah, and they
great.
Don't. I was really hoping for like an iMac with a Retina or like an upgraded Thunderbolt
it's
display.
It's only a
can
matter
you imagine,
of time.
I mean, oh, I know, but
yeah.
Can you imagine how much that's going to cost? Like the 27-inch Thunderbolt display with a Retina panel on it. It would be like $6,000.
Well,
right now.
This is what I was saying. I mean, you know, I'm sure they love to roll this out across every device they make, but the price point just isn't there yet.
Clearly, the 13-inch MacBook Pro will get it soon.
Oh, we've been seeing all sorts of rumors about that. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I've been checking out Apple Insider or a few other sites, and everyone is universally saying, yeah, 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro on the way soon. So.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason, I mean, it's less expensive for the smaller form factor, so the only reason that they would have really pushed the 15 is because that is the predominant pro notebook.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is
like, that's their baby.
So, and I guess I wonder what your thought is on this, but you know, the fact that this is a baseline, whatever, $2,700 laptop, would indicate to me that this is a pitch toward professionals to, you know, people who use the laptop for video editing or, you know, photography or whatever. But it seems to me like a lot of normal people are buying this thing.
Yeah. The display is fantastic. It is a very high performance machine. It has a great CPU. It has a good GPU for people that are doing gaming. It also has a very nice form factor. It's not as thin as the Air, but it's definitely one of the more, shall we say, streamlined notebooks of that
type. I mean, if you look at a comparable offering from like Alienware or something, you're going to see a much larger, chunkier.
Yeah. I mean, recently, PC laptop manufacturers have been following the Apple model to some degree and slimming down their notebooks, but no one is.
Okay, to some degree, did you see that HP that is an almost identical clone of a MacBook Air? And the guy that designed it was like, oh, I wouldn't say it's, come on. Like, there's some similarities. And I'm like, it is almost identical.
I remember reading that, what he basically said was like, isolated keyboards with black keys are pretty much a standard now anyway. So,
not the only thing. Yeah, that guy's a joke. But I think that I want to say I don't remember how much I paid for my old titanium, but I had I bought the second generation titanium PowerBook, and that was not cheap.
Yeah,
I think it was probably a similar price point. So I don't know. I mean, those are machines that are going to last for a while, too. My only concern would be on the pro side is that if you want to really get enough storage for all that video, you are either getting a Thunderbolt disk array or you're spending a lot of money for a big solid state drive on that.
So I think it's actually not. I don't think it's actually bad, because if you think about most professional video or photo or other media workflows, I mean, you're using giant external storage anyway. So the only difference is you're keeping less on your internal storage at a time. But the fact that your internal storage is so fast is probably such a win for those people, that it probably completely makes up for it.
Cause I want to say, let's see.
I mean, can you imagine video or photo editing on, a drive that is 10 times faster or whatever the SSD is over the hard drive?
Yeah, my SSD on my desktop is amazing. The Air has a good one too. I don't even know if my MacBook Air has like the quote unquote fast one, because I know there's two different SSDs that they use. But I'll tell you one thing: like, this thing boots like a bat out of hell, and I have no complaints. Like, I've never wanted my Air to be faster at anything.
Right.
Like, seriously. Like, I've never waited. I mean, the only time I ever was like, this is unfortunate, was like the one time that I was just curious and like tried to run a game on it.
Right. Yeah.
And I was like, eh.
Not the point of the laptop, as we said. No. So, yeah. So then the other news that came out of WWDC, the other big news, there are a couple tidbits of news, but the other big centerpiece was iOS 6.
So, and some really interesting tie-ins with Mountain Lion, too.
Oh, okay. I did not keep track of the Mountain Lion stuff. So if you want to enlighten us, feel free. But
we'll talk about Mountain Lion another time. But okay. The iOS 6 stuff was definitely the more interesting.
So for
most people, I think.
So you listed two things here, two big things that came to light in the coverage of this event.
New maps.
So yeah, Apple Maps is now a thing. They've replaced Google Maps as the default map source for the iPhone.
Yep. Which is clearly, Google's been kind of intentionally making maps on iOS a lesser product than maps for Android.
I didn't, or how so? I mean, it doesn't have turn by turn. Yeah.
No turn by turn, no traffic, any of like the integration stuff they've intentionally omitted.
Right. Yeah. Well, no crowdsource traffic. I mean, there's a traffic overlay.
Is there one for the Maps app on iOS?
Yeah, totally.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah. If Apple can control an aspect of their system, they are going to control that aspect of their system. They clearly now have the ability to provide their own mapping system, so they are going to do so. That's just the way they operate.
You and I disagree on this. I thought that their offering looked really good.
So I think that the turn by turn stuff looks pretty slick. Obviously, with Siri integration, it's going to be great. I think the purpose of a map should be upfront, simple, effective readability, and when you add a bunch of bezels and fake like freeway signs and 3D renderings, which Google is, of course, guilty of, too, of you know, let's put a bunch of 3D and mixed aerial perspectives. And, you know, it's like, just make the map simple, make it extremely readable, don't obscure the text in a bunch of bezels and fancy stuff, you know, concentrate on the roads, you know, the names and the landmarks, and, you know, leave it at that. Don't get fancy with it.
Well, okay.
Because, I mean, you know, what, like, other than as a discussion piece or as a, let me spend, you know, a few seconds browsing the Eiffel Tower or whatever, you know, or looking through New York City, I mean, maps are supposed to be a tool for finding your way around. And I, you know, I'm just, I really like maps. I'm a big fan of well-designed maps. And well-designed maps focus on really stark color contrasts, really simple, you know, simple lines, simple forms, extremely readable text, and these are all things that I see Apple Maps diverging from. So I just immediately had a reaction of, you know, that they've gotten too fancy with their presentation. So
interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing that I thought was really dumb was that they integrate it with Yelp.
I don't like
Yelp.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I don't really have an opinion on that either way. I mean, it, you know, I use
think
Yelp
it's a
occasionally.
Bad site.
So
I think it's, well, you don't really have a choice, right? Like,
yeah,
there's so many things that end up like taking you there, and I've never really found their website to be all that great.
Yeah.
Like I get it and I know how to use it, but I also don't like that, like, there's been people that have been like shaken down. Like Yelp will offer to like downplay bad reviews in exchange for like money. Have you seen that?
It seems like there, you know, there's an occasional story, or more than an occasional story, but every once in a while a big story pops up.
Someone been shaken down by Yelp. Yeah.
I think their stuff is usable for the most part, but I think you're right that it could be incredible, and it's functional.
I tried out the Google local reviews thing, and yeah. I wrote a couple of like little reviews. There's a lot of people that are mad that makes you use your real name though.
Oh, huh. So this is the one that they've integrated with Google Plus.
Yeah.
I wrote one review for a place I really like on campus here, but I thought it was, you know, seemed fine to me. But obviously they don't have the scope or the traction of Yelp. So that's, you know, I guess for better or for worse, still the place you gotta
go.
Well,
I think Google partnered with Zagat's for their stuff.
Yeah, that was cool. And I like the fact that they use the Zagat rating system. I think, you know,
yeah,
that makes a lot more sense than 5 stars. So
yeah, seriously. But I mean, to back up a little bit to the iOS thing, like, I understand what you're saying about the maps. I think I get it, and I think I don't agree necessarily. I mean, I don't think that it's that obtrusive, but the do not disturb thing is probably my favorite feature.
Oh right, yeah, I almost forgot about this. So
love that.
Yeah, what is do not disturb?
Well, if you don't want to have your phone in airplane mode because that turns off the radio, but you just don't want to be bothered, you can set the device into do not disturb. And what that does is it squelches the ringer and stuff, and like doesn't it still lets you use the device as you'd expect, but it doesn't make you get interrupted. So if you're like in a meeting or if you're taking a nap, anything like that, like you can put this on and it won't bug you. Now you can set like a priority list, so you can say don't bug me unless it's these people.
Yeah.
So
which is, you know, I mean, for a phone, that's great. Like,
that's really great.
Yeah.
And it's something that, like, it's one feature that Nokia was able to actually do a pretty good job with. Series 60 always had the Nokia's mobile OS for their smartphones, had a really strong profile system. And you could have different profiles for, like, you know, morning and evening, or, you know, whatever you wanted to call them. And then you could even set up like these phone groups. So, for example, you can make it so like your phone won't ring in the middle of the night unless it's, you know, from these numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. Google Voice does that, but,
Well, you can set do not disturb on Google Voice,
but I don't know if you can do specific numbers with it. Yeah.
Well, you can say people in this group get bounced to like the attendant or whatever.
Oh, okay.
And you can do something kind of similar with it, but, the other neat thing about Apple's approach is that you can make it so that, like if someone calls and then they go to voicemail and if they call right back, that it will ring through.
Huh.
So if you have like, you know, in your family, you can have like a little group says like, you know, if you call once,
yeah,
you know, once by land, two by sea.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you can kind of like do something like that, which is kind of clever.
I hope that doesn't just lead to a culture of people calling each other repeatedly in general.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. But I would imagine that that's a tunable variable that you can change. So.
Yeah. Cool. All right.
Like a secret knock. It's like the shaving a haircut ring. So we're actually running low on time. Do you want to talk about the safety stuff or the E3 stuff?
Let's run through the safety stuff because this is some pretty big stuff that came up recently and definitely relevant to what we normally address on this show. Lots of account and password compromises.
Running around
lately.
Well, Blizzard sent out like they sent up like the smoke signals on this one because Riot Games, which operates a multiplayer game called League of Legends, which I have heard of but I've never played. apparently, like their European servers were compromised, and a bunch of account information was taken. And the Blizzard people were notifying people because people very commonly will use the same email address and password for just about everything.
Yeah, well, especially between gaming accounts, you know, someone could have one username and password for their gaming. Yeah.
Well, they have like, you know, their Gmail accounts, their username, and then their password is "I like to play games."
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, they use that for everything because, you know, they don't want to forget their password and they like to play games. So there was that. There was an interesting report. There's an extension for web browsers. There's an add-on for Chrome and Firefox and Safari. It's called Ghostery. And what they do is they let you block some of the like analytics and tracking stuff that websites do, and they had a really interesting report, and we'll have that in the show notes. And what's interesting about it is they kind of break down like who's watching for what, obviously like Google Analytics is probably the predominant platform here, and it's not that necessarily Google is, you know, it's not like a nefarious plot to like monitor all your browsing. It's because they have all these analytics tools that people use,
right?
And it, you know, that's why it comes up. So it's Google and Facebook, I think, were the two largest.
And then I think Twitter was up there in the top 10, and then it's a bunch of companies you've never heard of.
Well, yeah, and those are the ones you gotta watch out for.
Yep.
Those are the guys that get taken down or like get there's been tons of problems with those guys because some of them also gather
as much information as they can possibly gather. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, along that line, though, Facebook is starting to use and check for cookies for other sites and services from their users.
Huh.
So, yeah.
So, I mean, this is generally not supposed to be possible that, you know, a website is not supposed to be able to access cookies for other websites. But if the Facebook script is embedded on someone else's website,
Then it's you know, essentially an include that lets them operate as if it was that site.
That website. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So that's nefarious.
Well, it can be. I mean, obviously it's not something that people expect from a reputable company to do unless there's a specific reason. But the other part of that is that they have like those so-called super cookies, right, that you cannot even delete or unset because they just come back. Like, someone's figured out a way that you can essentially set a permanent cookie that you can't get away from.
Really?
Let me see if I can find that.
Well, anyway, we can post a link to that in the show notes. But I guess that the overriding thing here is that if you are concerned, or you know, if you are just curious about where you're being tracked around the web, check out this report which describes the general case, as well as the add-on that it references. So
the quick version though on the super cookies is that of course most of them use Adobe Flash.
Ah, okay.
Because
you know
what they do is
that explains it.
they embed them in plugins. so that the browsers themselves, you know, don't have the cookie present, but when the plugin is loaded, then the plugin can do it for it. So like the plugin can even inject a regular browser cookie into a browser at the time of execution. So it's super shady. But the big compromise recently, though, was LinkedIn. And that was a very high-profile, shameful compromise.
Yeah.
There were 6.5 million accounts that were picked up by this. Now, they were encrypted passwords, so they weren't plain text, but they weren't salted. And what that means is that essentially when the password is done, it puts it through a hash, and then it stores that hash in a database. Now, that hash will be identical because they don't use like a unique salt for every individual password. So if you have kind of what they call rainbow table, which is a series of pre-computed password hashes, you can run down a list of hashes very quickly and then recover passwords that way.
So if two people have this, have the password, you know, say the most common password on LinkedIn, link, then both of those passwords will look exactly the same.
They will have the same
in the database. So
because they're running through a one-way hash and there's no salt. So that's not really a great practice, but it's a very common one. There are a lot of websites that you know and trust use this method of storing passwords. So I can't really, you know, on the one hand, yes, it's not a good practice, but it's one that, you know, to be fair, like, I don't want to set a lower standard or anything, but it's not something that we've expected more of. It's like people trust LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And there are people like, you know, where I work that are, you know, we've got some students that had their accounts compromised. They don't know. So the short version is if you get an email from LinkedIn or that claims to be from LinkedIn and says, you know, blah, 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 account compromised, change your password, and there's a link, it's bogus. LinkedIn has issued a statement that they will never send a hyperlink in an email ever. So the only way to access your LinkedIn account is to go to a web browser and type in linkedin.com and then log in to their website, which is a good practice. People should do that. People should not be clicking links in email. So bravo on them for that. But there are also people that are like, well, how do I know LinkedIn is safe? You don't, and you never did. Like this mythological safety net where, you know, you were volunteering all of this personal information to a company so that they could sell you advertising or whatever. Like, it was never a safe website. Because you have no expectation of it being safe or properly managed. It's like Sony. Like, the reason that the Sony compromise bit people so hard is that they had this notion that, like, you know, Sony knew what they were doing.
Right.
No, they don't. Of course they don't. Like, they're going to cut corners and they're going to cut costs and they're going to do whatever they can to... here's a
slight point on that, though. I mean, so, you know, Sony, I look at Sony and I think, well, they're not a software company, you know, primarily, right? But I look at LinkedIn and it's like they are primarily a data company. So you have this expectation that they know how to handle and protect data. I mean, you know, because it is so core to their business.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that they made the right decisions. So just because the people there, because I, to be fair, I'm not saying, you know, the people that write the code at LinkedIn are idiots. Like, I'm sure they know better.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that when they said, this is what we want to do to protect this, it's also possible that someone further up the line was like, well, we need to do it faster, or we need to, you know, do it simpler, or we need,
or that doesn't sound, you know, that important, or what.
And you know, for whatever reason, they made a decision, and that's the decision that they made. And I don't even know what the nature of the compromise was or how that even happened, but the fact that those passwords were stored that way, while it is not something that they should have been doing, it's something that you should realize is happening everywhere.
Right. Yep.
So the common passwords that you were looking through, now there was, so people have run these through password crackers and use these tables that we're talking about. And you can kind of tear through them awfully quick when you've got pre-computed hashes like that. You came up with a, should we say, poem?
The Mashable posted this list of the most common stolen passwords from LinkedIn. And they're all, you know, pretty common sense, you know, short words and common words and, you know, things people are thinking about. But when you put them all together and you read them in prose form, or in poetic form, really, you get this poem that I call Humanity's Desperate Cry. So So here we go. This is from most popular to least popular, leaving out expletives and numbers. So,
all right. Oh, no expletives?
No expletives here. Well, one, sort of. Here we go. Link work, God job. Angel, the I love sex Jesus. Connect, monkey master bitch. Michael Jordan, dragon soccer killer. Pepper devil princess, I love you career. And that is humanity's desperate cry seen through the list of most popular compromised LinkedIn passwords. And I think that will probably do it.
That is the website of movers and shakers in your business community.
Yes. All right. That will probably do it for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. If you want to contact us, the email is show@hellyeah.com. The web address is show.hellyeah.com. And
the Twitter machine, send us a tweet @hellyeahshow, twitter.com/hellyeahshow.
All right. With that said, we will hopefully see you next week.
Pepper Devil Princess, I love you.